This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 14th, 2019. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature, the Speaker of the British Columbia Legislature lays down the law, and the BC Liberals join the NDP in a caucus ad war. They're fighting with taxpayers' money. And the Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or is it time for City Hall to finally say no to the 420 Marijuana Festival in 2019? The Pot World's answer to P.T. Barnum, call him Pot Barnum, is promoter Dana Larson. He says it's a protest, but it's really a money-making festival that doesn't want to pay for policing services like the Pride Festival and so many other events do in Vancouver. Marijuana is now legal to buy and to smoke in Canada. You can puff on a joint on 419, just like you can on 421. You can roll a fatty all you want, 365 days a year. Larson has now hired 1990s hemp hip-hoppers Cypress Hill to play their classics, Insane in the Brain and Hits from a Bong. He promises free pot for all. There is no admission charge. The soccer field at Sunset Beach will be ruined again and closed for weeks, if not months. Enter John Cooper, the chair of the Park Board, who called an emergency meeting to find ways to prevent Cypress Hill from taking the stage on April 20th. I have a suggestion to cancel not only Cypress Hill, but 420 at Sunset Beach altogether. It would save the soccer field from ruin and save so much money in policing costs. Instead of Cypress Hill, let's actually have MC John Cooper and the Parks Board crew lip-syncing the greatest hits of Vanilla Ice and Snow and dropping beats. Yes, MC John Cooper and the Parks Board crew literally dropping beats for better digestion. And next year, why not sell tickets for $20 each for 4 hours of entertainment and limit the crowd to 20,000? Hold it at the P&E after agreeing to the long list of requirements to make sure it's a safe and fun event for all. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the South China Morning Post, Ian Young reports, Chinese tycoon's son buys $3.8 million U.S. Bugatti Chiron in Vancouver with dad's UnionPay credit card, complains about Canadian taxes. Chen Meilin's son, Ding Chen, posted a message on Instagram complaining about a $680,000 U.S. tax charge on his new supercar, saying they made his heart feel tired. A salesman at Wiseac, the Vancouver luxury car dealership that is selling the Bugatti Chiron, said China's UnionPay credit cards were a regular mode of payment. Ding Chen lives at the Vancouver mansion his father bought for almost $52 million in 2015. Meilin Chen was a member of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, which advises on lawmaking to the Communist Party government. In the Japan Times, Kyoto reports, firearm foul-ups. Man takes gun from Yokohama police officer and fires it. No one injured. Toshitaka Suzuki, 31, was arrested after firing the officer's pistol at an apartment complex. Two officers responded to an emergency call about someone kicking a vehicle. When the officers arrived, two men were fighting and the officers tried to break it up. The suspect grabbed one of the officer's guns and fired it. He was quickly restrained. The incident is the latest in a spate of incidents involving Japanese police officers either misplacing their guns or having them taken away. In June last year, a former member of the Self-Defense Forces fatally stabbed a senior officer at a police box in Toyama Prefecture before taking his handgun and fatally shooting a security guard at a nearby school. Earlier this year, the National Police Agency said it would introduce new holsters designed to make it more difficult for police officers to be disarmed during hostile situations. In the Los Angeles Times, Suhana Hussein reports, L.A. developer of celebrity real estate arrested in alleged $1.3 billion Ponzi scheme. Robert Shapiro, 61, the owner of the Woodbridge Group of Companies and two other company executives, were accused of conspiracy to commit mail and wire fraud and other violations of federal law in an indictment unsealed in the Southern District of Florida. Shapiro siphoned off $35 million for his own benefit, according to prosecutors, spending $3.1 million for chartering private planes and travel, $6.7 million on a home, $2.6 million in home improvements, $1.8 million in personal income taxes, $1.4 million to his ex-wife, and more than $672,000 on luxury automobiles. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines from around the Pacific Northwest. In the Tri-City Herald, Andreas Wiseman reports, Hope Solo was a Richland soccer star and world champ. Her story is bound for the big screen. The former University of Washington Husky is considered one of the top women goalies in the world, playing in three World Cups and three Olympics, winning two gold medals. The executive producers include Drew Brees and Tony Parker. Solo had a turbulent relationship with her father and a 2014 domestic violence arrest. And in the Haida Gwaii Observer, Shannon Lowe reports, West Coast Amusements cancels Northwest BC Carnival Tour. There will be no Ferris wheel or bumper cars in Prince Rupert, Terrace, or Kitimat this year. West Coast Amusements said it cannot provide carnival entertainment due to staffing issues. It is short of laborers and drivers. Prince George will be the furthest north the carnival will travel. And last week in the Breaker.News, these headlines. NDP government in no rush to add scandal-plagued legislature to BC's FOI law. BC Liberal caucus joins NDP in wasting taxpayers' money on partisan radio ads. Public sector pensions delay in reporting missing microfiche provokes privacy commish. Read the stories behind those headlines in the Breaker.News. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Silence in Victoria as the British Columbia legislature is on Easter hiatus for 2 weeks. The spring session reached new highs last week. Highs in volume and highs in frequency of heckling and interruptions by the BC Liberal opposition against the NDP government in question period. Andrew Wilkinson's party, inspired by the federal conservative wall of noise on Budget Day, was particularly disruptive on April 9th when I was in the press gallery. There were times that the NDP cabinet minister could not be heard above the noise from across the aisle. The Hansard TV audio does not fully do justice to the din when Labour Minister Harry Baines and Social Development Minister Shane Simpson tried to answer questions.
Mr. Speaker, we value workers, we value their work, Mr. Speaker.
Members.
That's why we are making changes. Stay tuned, more
Members.
Is coming.
Members, that action was completely out of order, and I remind you, Section 47 of the Standing Orders would allow me to disallow questions. So it's just forewarned on this. We will not be tolerating that action in response to a question.
A partnership that will be good for the millions of British Columbians who need their support. We're proud of that. We're happy of that. We're happy to finally have a government here that puts people first. Puts people first.
Speaker of the House Darrell Pluckis put his foot down a day later on April 10th with a lengthy statement to remind MLAs about the rules and consequences. He could ultimately have an MLA forcibly ejected for unruly behavior.
Members, we're about to start question period, but before we do, if I might make a statement, particularly out of a concern expressed by the House Leader for the Official Opposition yesterday regarding behavior of members in the House. And I want to begin by quoting to you parts of a email I received today, which is one not unlike ones I receive many per week. And it goes like this. Quote, yesterday I visited the legislature during question period as a chaperone for an elementary school field trip. I was delighted by the hospitality we received on our tour and the beautiful building. I was appalled and deeply saddened by the ugliness we witnessed during question period. The time was wasted in posturing, bullying, and name-calling. It was rather uncomfortable to watch with students. We teach to be, quote, be kind, be safe, be respectful, be responsible. That's their school motto. I receive lots of letters like that. I don't want to receive any more. I just want to point out, oral question period is an important accountability exercise and provides members of the Legislative Assembly with the opportunity to seek information from the government of the day and to hold the government to account. These are two fundamental responsibilities of our system of parliamentary democracy. It follows this vital proceeding as an important and central part of each sitting day. We must ensure that it functions as a public venue to canvass urgent and important matters that cannot be addressed through other proceedings. As such, it is helpful to review recent practice and the ongoing expectations with regard to oral question period. And again, I want to thank the House Leader for the official opposition for raising this issue yesterday. The standing order relates to oral question period is not new. Standing Order 47A outlines the basic expectations of this aspect of daily proceedings. I strongly encourage members to read Standing Order 47A and its accompanying narrative, Parliamentary Practice in British Columbia, 4th edition, pages 139 to 144. Presiding over oral question period is always a challenging role for a speaker. This is captured well in the 3rd edition of House of Commons Procedure and Practice, where it is noted at page 503, quote, presiding over daily question period is one of the most onerous and difficult tasks undertaken by the speaker. The speaker strives to ensure that question period is conducted in a civil manner, that questions and answers do not lead to debate, and that both sides of the House have an opportunity to participate. In recent days, it has become virtually impossible for the chair, and I would suggest for members as well, to hear proceedings during oral question period, particularly answers to questions. I do not think it is unreasonable to expect that members conduct themselves in a manner which shows respect for each other and this institution. In reviewing the 6 answered broadcasts of oral question period on April 1st through April 9th, I observed frequent interruptions, interjections, and general disorder reducing the proceedings to an ineffective exchange at the best or a spectacle at worst. With respect to questions about the role of the chair during oral question period, I make 4 submissions to the House. First, as Speaker, I am reluctant to interfere in debate, but I will do so if it appears that either the question or the response cannot be heard. House of Commons Procedure and Practice, 3rd edition, at page 503 states, the Speaker has discretion and authority to rule out any question posed during question period or to interrupt any member in the case of unparliamentary language, for example, if the Speaker is satisfied that it contravenes House rules of order, decorum, or procedure. Furthermore, as reflected in a decision of Speaker Hartley, recorded in the journals of May 31st, 2000, quote, as has been the practice in the past, the Speaker is reluctant to continually intervene, as I've had to do, bearing in mind the short duration of question period, but unless members on both sides of the House exhibit some self-discipline, the chair will have no option but to intervene. Second, I will exercise my discretion where is afforded to me by the rules of this House, including on allowing or disallowing a supplementary question, as provided for by Standing Order 47A, subsection C. In this respect, I note that the House of Commons Procedure and Practice, third edition, also notes at page 504, the Speaker retains sole discretion in determining the time that individual questions and answers may take, and the chair may interrupt any member consuming more than a reasonable share of time in posing or responding to a question. I think we should pay particularly attention to that because we've had some questions which go on too long and some answers which go on too long, and it hurts the ability to get more questions in. Third, I have a fundamental duty to uphold order and decorum in the House. I will not hesitate to ask members to come to order when such discretion is merited, and at any point during a sitting, including oral question period. Should a member make frequent, repeated, disorderly objections, I will ask that particular member to come to order. Should that member refuse to comply with a request, Standing Orders 19 and 20 extend certain powers to the chair to restore decorum in the House, which I am prepared to enforce. Lastly, I will note that when the red light at the table is illuminated at the end of question period, members must be succinct in stating their question or providing a brief response, as the case may be. The red light indicates the 30-minute time frame for oral question period has elapsed, and members should take note this is not an opportunity for extended commentary by either side. This discretion I have provided is well-founded and well-recognized in our Assembly as well in other parliamentary jurisdictions. Finally, I would remind all honourable members of the importance of maintaining order in all our proceedings, and I encourage members to review the commentary in Parliamentary Practice in British Columbia, 4th edition, pages 98 to 103, regarding language and decorum. There is one element of commentary that I would like to highlight when it comes to page 99. Quote, the proceedings in the House are based on centuries of tradition of mutual respect and integrity. I believe that it is possible to have passionate debate and exchanges about issues that we care deeply about without excessive noise, rudeness, and disturbances. It seems, judging by the correspondence I receive, that many of our constituents feel that our conduct and decorum do not meet their expectation. They do not meet their expectation as taxpayers. Poor behavior reflects badly on the Legislative Assembly, and I again ask that we be mindful of our responsibilities to constituents, to this institution, and to each other, and demonstrate respectful behavior in our proceedings. Thank you, Madam Clerk.
Oral questions by members.
The solitude lasted mere moments before BC Liberal House Leader Mary Polack interrupted Premier John Horgan.
This issue is critically important. This issue is critically important to the people of British Columbia. It's critically important to those in the members' constituency. And we are working with the public. We'll continue to work with the public to try and find... Member surely has her answer.
Yeah, Member for Langley. Like, this is outrageous. Like, I've just finished talking about decorum and being appropriate in the House, and we're not 2 minutes later, and we're behaving as people would expect that we should never behave. I'm sorry, I cannot tolerate this any longer. Member.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the interest of understanding the ruling, is it the Speaker's position that heckling is always out of order?
Silence.
I am not saying heckling is out of order. I'm saying that interrupting a speaker is out of order, and interrupting a speaker when they start is out of order. I don't know how clear I have to be about that. The average person in this planet would say that when somebody's speaking, it's appropriate to not interrupt. I'm sorry, that's what I mean. We will not have interruptions of a speaker. Member.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Respectfully, I would like to read from the website for the Parliament of the UK in describing the activities in the chamber. And I appreciate that a level of decorum should be maintained, but I also appreciate that in oral question period, there is also a tradition of a certain amount of leniency with respect to interventions. It is short. It says, and I quote, "The style of debate in the House has traditionally been one of cut and thrust, listening to other members' speech and intervening in them, in spontaneous reaction to opponents' views. This style of debate can make the Commons chamber a rather noisy place with robustly expressed opinion, many interventions, expressions of approval or disapproval, and sometimes of repartee and banter." And I would just submit, Mr. Speaker, and respectfully ask that we consider that there is, as the House of Commons procedure and practice states, there is, on the part of chair occupants, generally a practice of ignoring what they call applause and mild heckling.
Member, we are going to have to continue this conversation in the Speaker's office at a later time. We will continue now with question period.
Meanwhile, the BC Liberal Caucus has joined the NDP caucus in wasting undisclosed amounts of taxpayers' money on partisan ads.
That's 1-800-Bladder.com.
BC drivers are paying more for gas than anywhere in North America. 35 cents on every liter comes from NDP taxes. John Horgan and the NDP could give drivers tax relief on gas prices. Instead, they're taking more of your money to spend on themselves. Their union donors, friends, and insiders are all getting a cut straight from your pocket. Andrew Wilkinson and the BC Liberal MLAs are standing up for you. They're calling for tax breaks because you can't make BC more affordable by raising taxes. A message from the BC Liberal Caucus.
For now, there is no legal requirement for either caucus to tell the public how much the ads cost because they are using funds from the Legislative Assembly, which is not covered by the Freedom of Information Law. BC Liberal House Leader Mary Pollack said her caucus was abiding by parliamentary tradition and said it would be counter to practice to even disclose the spending amounts.
Because it is caucus funding which funds partisan activities, and the very nature of partisan activities is that you would not disclose to your opponent those things that you are engaged in the daily activities where you have the parry and thrust of debate and of communication of your various positions. That is part of our democracy.
Andrew Weaver, the leader of the Green Party, said both the BC Liberals and NDP should repay the public treasury. If they're going to advertise, Weaver said, they should use their own party funds, not taxpayers' money.
I shook my head. Am I surprised? No. Do I think it's right? No. Do I think the BC Liberals should be paying that back as well? Yes. Just because the BC NDP did this does not mean it's right to do.
Meanwhile, NDP House Leader Mike Farnworth told me this week that the legislature will not be added to the Freedom of Information Law until this fall at the earliest. In the wake of Speaker Daryl Plekis' reports on waste and corruption in the offices of the Clerk and Sergeant-at-Arms, BC's Information and Privacy Commissioner, Michael McAvoy, pleaded for the legislature to be added to the list of 2,900 public bodies across BC that are subject to the FOI law. Farnworth immediately accepted McAvoy's recommendation in February. The Legislative Assembly Management Committee heard that the legislature spent more than $70 million of taxpayers' funds through December 31, 2018. The committee also heard that retired Supreme Court Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin is still on track to report by May 3rd on the fate of suspended clerk Craig James and suspended Sergeant-at-Arms Gary Lenz. They were both suspended with pay for misconduct last November 20th and are both under RCMP investigation.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister says that he's put me on notice, hoping that I'll withdraw my statements. I'm not. I repeated them again outside. So I'm putting him on notice that I'm looking forward to the day that he sets for this court case to proceed. But when it comes to falsehoods, Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister stated that his excuse for interfering in this court case was because of jobs. We now know that that isn't true either. So once again, is the Prime Minister aware of the criminal penalties for committing perjury in a court case?
Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, I can understand the member opposite's frustration. His economic plan is in shambles. After 10 years of the lowest growth rate since the Great Depression under Stephen Harper, we turned that around with an approach that invests in Canadians, and therefore Canadians created over 900,000 new jobs over the past 3 years. We've seen the lowest unemployment in 40 years. Our plan is working, and yes, Mr. Speaker, we will always fight for jobs, and we will never apologize for fighting for jobs.
Speaker, the Prime Minister wants to talk about false statements. The Prime Minister said that his motivation for interfering in this criminal court case was because he was afraid that SNC-Lavalin would move their headquarters out of the country. The head of SNC-Lavalin has said that that is completely false.
Oh, wow,
so once again, is the Prime Minister aware of the criminal penalties that he would face if he said that falsehood under oath in a court of law?
Honourable Prime Minister.
Again, Mr. Speaker, we are unequivocal about standing up for jobs, and indeed, shortly after the head of SNC-Lavalin made those comments, the company came out and corrected the comments he had made. We have been consistent in standing up for jobs. We will continue to defend workers right across the country, whether it's our steel and aluminum workers, whether it's our forestry workers, whether it's in manufacturing. We know that investing in Canadians, investing in their communities, is way better than the cuts and austerity proposed by the Conservatives.
That's it.
Prime Minister just said another false statement, Mr. Speaker. A spokesperson for SNC-Lavalin said as late as last week that there is no intention on moving the headquarters from Canada.
That's fine.
But I guess the Prime Minister is worried about actually taking this to court, because everything that he has said outside this House in front of Canadians, if he were to say them again in a court of law, he would be guilty of perjury. I guess his famous just watch me has turned into a just watch me run away. Will he have the backbone to stand by his threats and show up in court to fight this case?
Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
What we have here is a Conservative Party flailing and floundering, trying to change the subject away from what matters to Canadians. They have no plan to fight climate change, no plan on the economy, and quite frankly, have continued to demonstrate, despite the rejection they got from Canadians in 2015, they still don't understand that the economy and the environment need to go together. And to build a stronger economy, you have to take action on fighting climate change. They fail to understand that, and therefore, they're looking for anything else to talk about.
Order.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau. Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Joyce Hardcastle, whose 1986 Nanaimo Bar recipe is considered the gold standard. She can make her own Nanaimo bars better than I can, but she didn't have the coveted virtual Nanaimo bar until now. Why now? Well, Ms. Hardcastle spoke up in defense of the Nanaimo bar after Canada Post released images of a new stamp showing a very poor rendition of the Nanaimo bar. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting. Custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 14th, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on April 14th in 1981, the first space shuttle, Columbia, completed its first test flight? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week, happy Easter.